Dr. Charles Press, Appropriate Units of Government, the Problems of Consolidation, October 28, 1971, at the Department of Agricultural Economics.
The economist of the Canadian Radio Television Commission, he will deliver a lecture on the effects of regulation on network television programming in the United States and Canada, November 1, 1971, room 3, Berkeley Hall, 3 o'clock. So, to the graduate students of our department and other graduate students, I would like to announce there's an election on representatives to the decision-making process within the college and the university. Ballot boxes are up in our departmental office. Speaker for today is Dr. Charles Press from the Department of Political Science, and we ask him to present a seminar or his ideas to the problem of government, appropriate size of government, problems of consolidation. Please.
Thank you. I'm going to start off by drawing on the board, and please interrupt me if you have questions. Essentially, I want to start off talking about the metropolis and the way that it grew in the past and what's happened in the present and how this has changed. Essentially, I assume that the metropolis was organized on an economic basis, that people moved to the city for economic reasons. Now, there are exceptions to this. The black coming from the south had an economic motive, obviously, moving up to the northern city, but he also may have had a social motive. There's a sense in which cities are free. I think the medieval slogan was city air is free, meaning that all sorts of oddballs are attracted to the city because they are not the social pressure, the gossip of the small community doesn't affect them. So you get artists, bohemians, and all this sort. But essentially, most people come to the metropolis for economic motivations to get a better job. Now, Grand Rapids is a good illustration of what happened. Why we have what's essentially called a metropolitan area problem. The pattern of development in Grand Rapids went something like this. The original city, as I recall, was somewhere around 1837. Please don't quote me exactly by date. They added an annexation, and the interesting thing is it's a complete ring around the city in 1850. But note that it's a complete donut. Then you began to get the effects, partly as they spread out, it gets harder to ring the city, but you begin to get some resistance to annexation. And you had annexation something like this, as I recall, a little bit in every corner. Now, the pattern here, you see, was that up till this point, in order to get city services, in order to get conveniences, getting close to where the industry was, you lived on the fringe of the city. And there were very few people who could afford to live anywhere else. Now, the exceptions are the very wealthy. But in cities like Philadelphia began moving out. You may have heard of the Main Line in Philadelphia. That refers to the railroad that goes out of Philadelphia. And the exclusive suburbs that were on that railroad and people moving in back to the city to work, but coming in on the morning Main Line train. But up to this point, if you're going to get city conveniences, you lived on the fringe of the city. Now, about this period, you begin to get inventions, namely the motor car being the most important, which allowed people to scatter out. And again, the very wealthy were the first to take advantage of it. And so you've got East Grand Rapids over here, which was and still is a very wealthy, high-income suburb, a typical shaded streets kind of area. And settled initially, you see, because people who owned cars were wealthy, they could drive in and drive out, whereas poorer people didn't own cars in the old period, 1910 through 1920. I think this was officially incorporated in 1926. Now, from this point on, you begin to get get scatteration. You get your biggest scatteration in 1930 with the Depression. You begin to get low-income people moving out all over. But the thing that happened, you see, is with the invention of the septic tank, the automobile, even the lawnmower, the power lawnmower, all these conveniences, you could live out here. There's another little village that became part of the area, Granville, that's out here. It started as a rural trading center. It's now really part of Grand Rapids metropolitan area. But people began to move out all over here and scatter around. And this pattern then is broken. You can no longer expect people who get city services to live on the fringe of the city. You can no longer blackmail them into annexing, in effect, you see. Now that means you no longer have a central government. What happened then was you had separate incorporation. You had this incorporation here. You had Wyoming incorporated as a city. Grand Rapids managed some annexation in here, but you had Walker out here incorporated as a city. It was a township. And so forth, you see. But you now have a scatteration of governments through the whole metropolitan area. And that's really where the problem comes in. That you scatter people out, you no longer have growth along the edges. These people are capable of forming independent units, do form them. This is a blue collar unit. This is a mixture of rural and high income. This is somewhere in between the middle class. This is the same as Grand Rapids Township. Now, that brings me to my second point about metropolitan areas, and a fairly important one, is that people scatter out on the basis, first of all, social status. They group together, and this is partly an economic matter, because housing in certain areas has a certain price tag to it. But they gather together also on the basis of ethnicity, on the basis of religion. And of course, I include race in that. And so you get within the city all kinds of enclaves, and outside of the city, the same kinds of enclaves of people. Now, the theory is supposed to be that there's a melting pot, and this was the initial theory in the United States, the immigrants came in, they'd all be melted together into some new kind of American. That you have sort of an interchangeable parts system. And this hasn't really worked out. You have things happening, and I won't take Grand Rapids, but in other cities. You have things happening like a community here, which may be the Jewish settlement in the city, moving out in the suburbs, but all the community moving out, you see, into the same suburb. Partly this may be the result of churches. You have a Catholic church, let's say it's a Czech Catholic group. The church has moved out into the rural area, the township area, and people naturally congregate around it. And you keep the same sort of ethnic group, perhaps diluted to some degree, but still in the suburbs. You get then Jewish suburbs, you have black suburbs, you know, Inkster and Detroit settled this way. And so the metropolis is scattered out by social status first, secondly, ethnicity or race, and related ethnicity and race is clearly religion. Now this is the background, you see, of the problems that you have. I perhaps should have added, you know, in this point, in this old city, you have the wealthy people living downtown, literally. As you know, if you go downtown Lansing, you can see the big homes that the wealthy had right on the edge, right around the capital area. In Detroit, you have the circle, the city downtown, and the wealthy homes around this circle. Semicircle, really. And the wealthy were the first to move out. Industry followed them out. And so you now not only have these ethnic patterns out here, our social status patterns, but you begin to get industry following the following from the central city out into the suburbs. And so you have, in Grand Rapids, you have a General Motors plant down there and other industry. In addition, what's happened, and I'm sure you're all familiar with this, is that the blacks in the central city are getting closer and closer to control of many central cities. We almost had a black mayor of Detroit last time. I don't know what percentage of Detroit is black, but I think it was something like 40%. Richard Austin, still almost got enough votes to be elected. You have a black mayor of Cleveland with white votes, but still, you're getting closer and closer to the majority. Now, what's happening with the blacks in the central city is that our initial surveys of metropolitan area organizations, we go in and say, well, you know, what are you in favor or not? Blacks were either indifferent or they were in favor of metropolitan organization. This is about the way it turned out. Now you find blacks who are opposed to metropolitan organization. And I think you can see why. And they say, we're just about ready to take over city government. Now you want to merge us in with the rest of the suburbs and dilute our strength down to where we'll again be 20 or 30% of the population. In many central cities, they're moving to 30, 35, 40, and soon we'll be majorities. I suppose within the next decade, we'll be majorities in some central cities. So that this complicates, you see, the problems. Now, to go back over, what I've said in effect is that you have a scatteration over wide areas, and the scatteration tends to be in terms of certain patterns, styles of life, if you want to call it that, social status and ethnicity. And that this complicates any notion about what kind of a government would be best suited for a community. Now I'll talk a little bit about the problems that are created with trying to set up one central government or set up any sort of the best system. Let me go first of all to the notion of interchangeable parts. And this would be the efficiency and economy values. In the 30s, the reform movement, which largely comes through the Public Administration Service in Chicago, the National Municipal League, and their journal now called the National Civic Review, formerly the National Municipal Review. You had the emphasis on values of efficiency and economy, as if you could organize this area strictly in terms of what is the most efficient, what is the most economical. Let me give you an example of some of the drawbacks of this, and then go on to some of the strengths of this sort of analysis. When I first came to Michigan, I was in Muskegon working on a study, and one of my colleagues had discovered that in North Muskegon, which is right across the river, an important boundary, I might point out, important social boundary, in North Muskegon, it cost $18 per citizen to collect garbage. Trash, whereas in Muskegon it cost $6, I think it was, to collect garbage and trash a year for a citizen. Now the point of this, and I think all of us recognize it almost immediately, is that the people in North Muskegon really didn't give a hang. They were all fairly wealthy to begin with. They could well afford the extra $12 a year for garbage and trash if it kept out of their communities, as I think they believed, though I don't know that anybody ever published this fact. If it kept blacks out of their community, they were quite happy to pay an extra $12 a year and have a more inefficient government. If it even kept out middle class or lower middle class, they would be happy to pay it. If it kept out somebody who wanted to put in a public housing unit, let's say, or a low rental housing unit, or even a middle-income, what they would call cracker box housing, they would still be much more willing to pay that extra $12 in that service and in many others to keep the community the way it was. If you've driven through it, you know, it's a community sort of like, it looks like it was in a woodland area with trees scattered around and houses here and there, and no sidewalks, and, you know, suburban living at its greatest, looking out over the river and the bay into Lake Michigan. So the efficiency in economy, you see, is not the only value, but let me go through and talk briefly then about some of the importance of the efficiency in economy values. First of all, when you look at just efficiency in economy, are you going to save money? Are you going to get better service? You almost always come out in favor of the larger unit. Let me qualify that to one degree, but no further. You will come out for the larger unit if the choice is between independent units and a larger unit composed of several independent units merged. You may still come out for some decentralization, but decentralization is not the same as independence. Decentralization means that a central body has decentralized certain functions to other units, local units, but these it may take back at any time it wishes. If you decentralize in the Department of Agricultural Economics, you may set up an ad hoc committee of some sort and say it's your job to go out and recruit an economist in this area. If the department as a whole decides at some point they don't want that ad hoc committee to go out and do this anymore, they want somebody else to do it, they can immediately draw. I hope I'm not using an illustration that has direct relevance. But they could immediately say, we don't think that committee's doing a good enough job. We take the power back. They will no longer do this. The university can do this to departments and so forth. Now, independent units are more like the relationship with the United Nations, where the United Nations would say, we think all nations should not send oil to Rhodesia. But some nation of 2 million finds it's very profitable to send oil to Rhodesia, and they say, we're going to send oil to Rhodesia, you can say what you want. That's independence, you see. Now, I'm saying that if you talk in terms of efficiency in economy, almost always you end up with the larger unit. You may decentralize within the larger unit, but you get away from the independent vetoes of many small units. You have savings, for example. Let me talk in terms of the economy. You have savings in terms of staff services. This university has central purchasing. It has a central library, which services not everybody, because there are also decentralized libraries throughout the university. But these are at the official permission of the central library. They will have a special science library built someplace. But you save in these kinds of staff services, personnel recruiting, a civil service system. You save again in services that are impossible for a small unit to provide for itself. Training of firemen. Firemen like to have towers they can climb around and, you know, they can also swing around. And usually it's quite obvious that the best way to set up this kind of a system is the way they do in Grand Rapids, one central training system for all the firemen in the area, and they all somehow contribute to this. So that almost always when you see a study that's based solely on economy and efficiency, you'll come out with arguments for centralization. Do I need to give other illustrations? Professionalization is more likely to occur with a larger unit. If you have a small system of schools, of independent districts, you don't have a specialized teacher in art, let's say, or you can't have laboratories because the small districts independently can't afford them, and so forth. You go on through all these sort of economies that you get and efficiencies that you get when you may move to a larger unit. Now, a difficulty with the efficiency in economy beyond this is that usually a number of people have tried to do studies to discover whether there is an optimum unit for urban areas, an optimum size unit. One that I'm familiar with, and there may be others that have come since, but it seems to me a fairly landmark study, was done by Otis Dudley Duncan, a sociologist. And he discovers, as you might expect, that the size of the unit varies with the functional service. That for hospitals, you need a certain size unit for a hospital. He tries to take the statements of various groups, professional groups, about what they think would be the size of a unit, say,
American Medical Association, and probably one of the more specialized groups having to do with hospitals, has published figures, and they say in order to have a decent hospital, you must have at least this many citizens. Well, all sorts of other groups have done this. Usually they're inflated, let me say. They call optimum size or optimum performance standards are usually way up here, you know. It's like the FBI and jails. There are only 5 jails in the country or something that would qualify by these optimum standards or optimal standards. In jails, it may be a few more than 5, but it's a very small number out of total is what I'm trying to indicate. Nevertheless, these units find different sizes. So that if you're looking, even in efficiency and economy terms, about what is the best size of a city, or to govern an urban area, or a manageable urban area, you find that it varies with the function to some degree. There have been people, reformers, who've tried to set up cities, self-contained cities, that try to do this. You may know of the Garden Cities, which grew out of Ebenezer Howard's writings, his first book, or his, I guess his major work, a pamphlet called Garden Cities of Tomorrow, in which he argued we need to set up new towns, and these should be 30,000 in size. Now, the Labour government in England did set up some new towns, and perhaps some of you have visited them, but they're up to around 100,000 now, as a matter of fact, some of them. They vary. But it was an attempt, you see, to set up a self-contained community with an optimal size. And the notion was you'd do everything in this community. You'd get your groceries, you'd work, you'd whatever else you wanted to do, you could find it in this community, art museums and so forth. Well, that's a good example, just incidentally, art museums. You can see the size of community you need to set up a decent art museum, such as the Art Institute in Chicago, is certainly different than the size you might need for some of the other services. So you run into that problem. An additional problem with the efficiency and economy values and the arguments of efficiency and economy are the notion that services throughout a city are identical. And this is sort of implied in the arguments you get. But it really just isn't true, as you'll note if you go down through any city. Partly it's not true because of the efficiency, maybe, of the people running the city. Up until recently, the people who decided on building new schools, new libraries, other public services within a city would always put them in the nicer, in quotes, areas. They argued, why put a library down in the slums, a new library building? This area is deteriorating, it's going to pot, why should we waste our resources down here? We'll put it out in the middle class areas of the city where a library will fit in nicely. I note that other units do this also. Churches don't build new buildings, as a rule, in areas they think are deteriorating, and I suppose the A&P doesn't put chains down in areas that they think are deteriorating unless they can see some way of making a special profit. But whatever the reasons for this is, you go through a city as, for example, Chicago, you'll find the worst schools are in the slum areas. Yesterday I walked, day before yesterday, I was in Chicago walking through, really by accident, through slum area again of Chicago, and it's a pretty grim reminder. I'd gotten off at 63rd Street from the IC going to the University of Chicago, the center, and I should have gotten off at 59th. The result is I'm walking through the black slum area and deciding, perhaps unwisely, that really, the shortcut through these side streets was the closest way to where I was going, which was true, but I found myself in the middle of an area in which there were only blacks, and in which windows are broken in the apartment buildings, if you call those things apartment buildings, trash on the street, bottles are around, and so forth. And it's fairly grim and fairly depressing, actually. And well, in any case, what I'm saying is services are not distributed equally, as the economy and efficiency arguments would have you believe. I mean, it doesn't happen automatically, let me put it that way. The services may vary by the area of the city. I don't know if that's even, I suppose you could make the argument that's true even of as relatively a homogeneous community as East Lansing. Certainly the students would make that argument, I'm sure. services would not be distributed equally, but excluding even the students, I'm not sure even over the residential area, you might not make that argument. Now, another point about efficiency and economy is that generally the arguments are made in terms of efficiency and economy. And they're made saying, well, if we merge these units together, we will save this much money. What tends to happen is the money's never there after they've merged the units. I suppose most of you could guess what happens. You merge the units, and now you've got a police chief who, instead of having a one-car department, looks at this big area and he says, we've got to have a squad of six cars. And, you know, you immediately begin to professionalize, and as soon as you professionalize, you begin to spend money. And the costs go up almost immediately. If Meridian Township moves to a city, though please don't quote me to the Meridianites, they no doubt, one of the things that would happen is as a city they become more professionalized perhaps and begin to spend more money on services. Now the services will be much better at the same time, I should point out. But it's likely that the savings go into improved services. Now, what happens then, using the efficiency and economy values, what I've tried to do is say this is one way of looking at how do you find the best form of government for a metropolitan area. Using those values, you almost always end up with larger units. I pointed out some of the problems with this, that you don't get the savings, at least in money, but you do in better services, perhaps. Some of the other problems related to this, using this value. But nevertheless, if you use these values, you will come out for larger units. The people using them will tend to say, we should annex areas to the central city. Now this may be impossible because people in the suburbs will not vote to annex, or may not vote to annex, and they may get voted down, or they may be completely reined by suburbs that are non-incorporated and they can't do anything about it. Then they will move to special district governments as a second method. A special district is the largest, it's the fastest growing government in the United States today. Usually is a single-purpose special district. There are a few multi-purpose special districts which have more than one function. Most of them have one function. The Port of New York Authority, which now runs Holland Tunnel and the port and is even getting into the commuter business, this is a multifunctional one. But more commonly, you get a sewage district, which deals only in sewers and nothing else, or in a water district and so forth. And you get then, over the whole government, you tend to get a special district which would cover, say, most of the metropolitan area. In Grand Rapids, it was water that was the big, there was a big push for a water authority. They get their water by going into the Grand River, which in the fluent times insults them aesthetically because some people claim to tell the difference in taste between Grand River water and Lake Michigan water. I'm not sure whether you can or can't, but in times of real crisis, they have to go to Grand River water. But this is, there's a certain social status involved here. They don't really like to drink Grand River water. If you follow the Grand River up through its various tributaries, you can perhaps understand why they might have a little hesitation. Even though it's been going through their filtration plant. So instead they build the lines out to Lake Michigan and get water from Lake Michigan. But that's very expensive. And in order to do that, you've got to get a lot of units going together. Besides that, the city doesn't see any advantage in getting the water and then having suburbs incorporate around them. You know, they figured let the suburbs and join Grand Rapids and we'll increase our water lines. Wyoming eventually did build a separate line out to the Great Lakes and then supply some of the other suburbs so that they can fight annexation from Grand Rapids. So normally you get that kind of a move towards a special district. In a few cases, you do get a metropolitan area government. And almost every one of these, this has been forced somehow from the top. Now, I'm overstating it perhaps, but the pattern
is that of Toronto, Canada, where the provincial legislature decided we're going to set up a metropolitan city of Toronto. And the people of Toronto had an opportunity to testify in the provincial legislature, but that was all. They weren't particularly happy about it. They didn't have a vote against it. You had the same thing to a lesser degree in Miami, Dade County's Miami metropolitan government group, which is really a county government. They set the vote up so that there would not be vetoes from individual communities, but so that there would be a countywide vote. Mm-hmm. And if the vote were favorable countywide, then you had a metropolitan authority, a metropolitan government. If it were unfavorable, you didn't. Well, you had then a vote which was overall favorable, but you found a lot of these local communities voting heavily no, but their vote was lost in the overall. I would guess there are going to be more of these. Indianapolis has moved this way in Nashville, but this is it. These are the four metropolitan governments. Winnipeg has also had one set up by the provincial legislatures. There are five on the U.S. continent, on the North American continent. I hope no Canadians present said that. Now, let me go on some of the other values and indicate the difficulty you see in finding a standard what unit of government would best suit people. If you decide that people are not interchangeable parts, but that they do have separate lifestyles, then you begin to look at the problem perhaps in a different way. You can overemphasize this, I think, but still it becomes an important variable. Our studies, for example, show that suburban annexations occur most frequently where the central city is more middle class than lower class. That is, if you take the central cities in the United States and categorize them by the census data you have, by the profiles of their populations, you find that annexations occur in those cities which are more likely, where the middle class is a larger share of the total city. In other words, suburbs will annex when they look at the city, central city, and say, well, these people are still pretty much like we are. When you get a central city which has moved more, at least in the eyes of, well, in actuality, has moved more towards lower middle class dominance, you get much more resistance to annexation. Okay, and I would say that this is an indication of lifestyle being perhaps of some importance, that people in the suburbs say we're not like those people in the city and we'll resist as long as we can. You find that suburbanites, secondly, one of the studies done in the Philadelphia area shows that suburbanites would go in, and this is particularly true of upper income suburbanites, but you get a sort of a pecking order of suburbs in the Philadelphia area, showing that they would only go with people close to them on the pecking order on merging on services that are important in terms of lifestyle, education being the most important of all, with zoning and planning, this sort of thing being second in importance. They'd be quite happy to work with a low income or a different kind of suburb or the central city on something like sewage disposal, particularly if the plant were located in the other suburb. And these kind of arrangements you'd find frequent. Then you'd find some that are neutral, like fire departments. You tended to make mutual aid agreements or make actually a consolidated fire department among suburbs. In terms of social status, it was less important than schools and zoning, but you know, had some importance, but not as much. Clearly, you don't care as long as the fire departments get there, but you may have some feelings. But sewage was least. You didn't really care who you worked with there. Now, what you're getting in reverse, in the central cities you have, as you know, in the Ocean Hill, Brownsville area, the arguments, the same kind of arguments used by blacks against being merged into the central city school system. In this case, I suppose the bitterest arguments, and to use really the ethnic terms, are between the teachers union, which in New York City, which had a heavy white membership. If you had any ethnic group, I suppose it had a heavier than the population of Jewish in the teachers union. And then you had the blacks on the other side, and you had a fight between these, and in some cases a very tragic fight,
because often the teachers who were whites were trying desperately to improve the situation in these black, really ghetto schools. But you also had this sense of we should control our own schools, we have a different lifestyle, we're blacks, and we shouldn't be told what to do. Now, this I'm pointing out to you, see, is another value that intrudes when you say, what is the ideal system of government? I can't tell you how important it is, except after the fact. I guess that's really but what we're saying. We know it's of importance when we propose mergers. If you propose the merger of East Lansing and Lansing, I would guess that this has a large influence. I think it's most found in the school systems in the suburbs. The schools really take the place in suburban areas almost of the cathedral in the medieval town, that you sort of point to your high school as a kind of an example of what this city can do. We have a swimming pool in our high school. If you go live out in that high school area, why, they don't have a swimming pool. And you have to, you know, you don't get the same good services. And I suppose a resistance between East Lansing and merger of East Lansing and Lansing would, to some degree at any rate, have to do with lifestyle, and perhaps also the ethnic racial problem would be important. Oh, I shouldn't say perhaps, I think pretty clearly it would in the minds of many of the residents of East Lansing if this were put to a vote. Now, there may be other arguments, but this does come in. It is a real, it is of real importance when you're trying to say what is an ideal city or what's an ideal size unit. If you think of people as interchangeable parts as they are in sewage service, then the ideal size unit may be the whole metropolitan area, because the cost of building separate sewage plants, just because you're an Italian-American community and you don't want to get along with the Polish-American community, you just say this is silly. But the cost of merging school systems may not be silly. Okay, I've made that point. Now, let me go to the other value that I think is important, and that's really the value of democratic control. You can overdo, you see, this self-sufficiency that we are separate, therefore we should have a separate unit of government. It seems to me that there's some problems which are metropolitan-wide, and I'm now speaking my own values and the values of many who I suppose do research, who argue that you do need a central control, not necessarily for efficiency and economy reasons alone, but to achieve a rough equity, I suppose, within the area. That when you get, as you do, let me give you just an example out of having nothing to do with ethnicity. If you look at Muskegon, Roosevelt Park down there. Do you know why Roosevelt Park is a separate city? Does anybody find the name FDR Roosevelt was named that? Anybody know Roosevelt Park? It's a separate city because Campbell, Watt, and Cannon has a big foundry right there, and the taxes in Roosevelt Park, therefore, are fairly low because it's built around the foundry, and they have the tax base, and so therefore they can remain independent. When you look at something like that, you ask the question, well, should this really be the case? Should you permit separate independent units because they can exist through some fluke? We find that whenever you add a big amount of money into a township, you get a big tax base within an area of a township, you get a rush towards incorporation. And usually there's a race to see whether you're going to incorporate around the factory or whether it's going to be the whole township, but everybody's worried. This happened when General Motors went into Warren. It happened when Livonia, when the state decided to give money back to racetracks, and Livonia had a racetrack. And there's several other instances of this where you suddenly get a big tax base in the middle of it. It seems to me, in terms of democratic values, you can ask, is this really to the social benefit to allow independence on this basis, because by some fluke they have a large tax base, other units have small. Now, you notice this is being attacked in our society by, I'm not sure successfully, but I'll point out to you this being attacked in two ways.
that's being attacked through the courts mainly. The one is the case in California, which I'm sure some of you are familiar with, which says that when you have unequal tax bases in school districts, this goes against the Equal Opportunity Clause of the Federal Constitution, and is trying to, and California courts have ruled out the property tax as a basis for school taxes. My only fear is that the city government will then come in and take up the slack left by the property tax for school and raise the city government taxes. I speak as chairman of the Board of Review, so I'm not wholly uninterested, I suppose. The second case is clearly in relation to busing. You can see what I've talked about in terms of independence of units to preserve special school districts is hit head on with the notion of busing students from one unit to the other. Not only do you break down the possibility of having your own separate school system, but you also break down even the sense of school taxes going to pay for a particular school system. If I'm living in East Lansing and paying school taxes and my kids are going to school at Sexton High School being bused over there, and East Lansing then floats a school bond issue, you can see my enthusiasm might be less than it would be under other circumstances. I'm not just speaking myself, I'm talking about this generally. The school busing decision seemed to me to aim at the heart, really, of independence of units. And this may be, and certainly is one of the reasons why the tremendous outcry against the busing decisions. I guess what I'm trying to say about the democratic control value is the sense that at least political scientists have that there should be a government that is controlling an area's development. My own view is that it's perhaps wise to start with the assumption that people will be somewhat selfish in their desires and try to guide the selfishness into socially desirable methods rather than in non-socially desirable methods. For example, you know that people are going to want to build hot dog stands along Grand River Avenue, and they have all the way from the what used to be the Lucan Theater when I used to go to movies, but I don't know what it's called, Campus Theater now, isn't that what it's called? All the way from the Campus Theater out to the edge of town, you find one hot dog stand or deep fry place after another. Now the result is to drive along there, you're continually getting traffic coming in on both sides of you from various units. You can, of course, rule out the possibility of these stands being built. I mean, just say, you know, we won't have these. Or you can perhaps try to guide the development of these stands so that the result won't be as horrendous as it would have been, you see, as it has been, it seems to me at any rate, from a traffic point of view. My own notion is that government perhaps deals with, at least to some degree, has got to deal with the selfish motivations of people and try to guide those motivations. This, incidentally, is what the Founding Fathers tried to do in our Constitution. They assumed people would be selfish rather than idealistic, and they set up a system of conflicts within the government, conflicts of various units against each other, because they had a very low opinion of human nature. They didn't trust anybody, even themselves, I guess. And so they set up separation of powers, conflicts and balances, and so forth. Now, I would still say, nevertheless, you've got to, there is a sense of a public interest in a whole metropolitan area, and this should be represented through some sort of a government. That independence in certain respects really is at the expense of all the other units within the area. Now, these are the values, you see, that are in conflict today. The efficiency and economy people make studies in which they overlook largely the problems of ethnicity, the problems of lifestyle, social status. I've tended to emphasize the ethnic rather than the social status, but it's equally valid in terms of social status. People who live in $40,000 ranch homes look down their nose at or don't really welcome $15,000 ranch home developments in their area. People who live in areas of individual homes have been known to fight the building of apartment complexes in their areas and so forth. Residents in college towns sometimes fight the building of other types of structures in their areas and argue there's a difference of lifestyle involved here. These are the values that are in conflict: efficiency and economy, some sort of social status values, and I think the sense of governance of a whole area, controlling the whole area. And out of this, we're getting a pressure, I think, more and more to larger units of government. Partly this is because in our age, the motor car makes it possible to have larger units. Counties, for example, were set up really with the notion that you could drive by horse and buggy anywhere in this land area, go into the county seat, and be back home by nightfall. And that was the way you decided the size of a county. You can do that much easier today. I suppose you can with a car, though I'm not sure. Maybe with a horse and buggy you could do it faster from some points than a county. But in any case, we could have larger units. We do this in many ways. The health department, for example, in the state, we have 83 counties. The health department now has encouraged the state local health departments to merge facilities so that we have, in effect, I think it's 35 health units. In this county, we have a county health department, just Ingham alone, but as you go up towards the UP, you'll find multi-county health departments, the result being they can hire a doctor and pay him a decent wage and so forth. My own guess is that the big push will be to improving county government, making it the more viable of the units of government for urban problems. And where you really have urbanization spread across many counties, pressuring more and more towards some sort of metropolitan experiments. In Detroit, we have a voluntary association, which is appointed to by nationally many times in many publications, but is really still voluntary. It's kind of like the League of Nations or United Nations. You send your delegate and he listens, and then he comes back and you decide whether you want to go along with it. But this is at least a step to some cooperation. You secondly have the state and the national governments forcing coordination. The national government through its various grants programs, the state government through its programs, a highway department, for example, forcing highways at least to be built in a more rational pattern. Not always successful, I might point out, for those of you who have observed recent events in the Lansing area, but at least pressuring in the direction of a metropolitan-wide planning of their particular function. As I say, I think that the most likely in the next decade, the governments that will gain most in strength will probably be the county governments, because they're a natural unit to take over. States are moving in the direction of allowing more professionalization. Michigan has county home rule, which the legislature has really never written legislation in its constitution. The legislature may write a county home rule act, but they've really never written one that's permitted genuine home rule, which would be getting rid of some of the elected officials and streamlining. In effect, we still have a county without an executive and with a kind of a holding company of disparate functions. The sheriff is separately elected and goes out and does pretty much, not completely, but pretty much what he wants to. He still has to come to the county board for money, but he still is fairly independent, which is not true, for example, in a city where you have a police chief who's appointed and is part of the city government. That's the difference. But I think the county will be streamlined. Well, I've done a lot of talking, so I'll stop and let you ask the questions. Yes?
Yeah, two questions. Do you make the assumption, or have you made the assumption, that the political process, democratic political process of electing people, will operate equally well at different sizes? And secondly, the administrative process. It seems to me that these two things might have quite an effect on outcome size.
Yeah, well, Well, let me go to the political first. The studies we have are inconclusive, in the sense that it clearly isn't size alone that determines participation. I mean, there are many other variables that do. Let me just give you an example. Blacks were low voters up until recently. They are now sometimes outvote whites within some of the northern communities. The reason's obvious. Up until formerly, they didn't see why it was worth voting because there were no payoffs. Now they begin to think, well, here's a black running for mayor of Detroit. Of course, blacks are going to vote. And they begin to see some, even when blacks aren't running for the office, they may see some direct payoffs. And so you're getting a difference in participation among these groups. A second thing that happens is that high participation, and again, political scientists don't have any direct any cutoffs we can give you, but we do know that extremely high participation means real trouble in the community. That when you got, for example, a vote, as a few years back Belgium had with between the Catholics and the Socialists, I think you may remember the pictures of the battles back and forth, and some sort of a vote over the king, the participation level went extremely high, you know, up in the 90s someplace, which is way high. Let me add one other little bit of evidence to give you some notion. Australia has a required voting, and in this required voting you get 5% normally who don't vote. The required voting is enforced by the fact that you pay an extra tax if you don't vote. You still get people who go down and actually vote but cast blank ballots because they don't know who to vote for, but they don't want to pay the tax, meaning there's always some portion of the society that doesn't vote. Now, the other things that affect voting and really affect it are the costs. And it's clear from all our studies that the people that see voting or see any political participation as costing them more are the low income, the low educated, the people peripheral to the system, the very young, the very old, those who are least involved. Homeowners vote more than non-homeowners. Middle-aged vote more than either very old or very young, and so forth. So I guess what I'm saying is I'm not sure that size is really that important. One study of Los Angeles could find no relationship between size and participation in a series of votes. You tend to think there should be, but there often isn't. I suspect the reason is because in some communities it doesn't matter. You know, a couple years ago in East Lansing, nobody would even run. And it really didn't matter who won too much, except for the immediate families or the candidates they might think it was important, but now it becomes very important, so you're going to get a higher turnout. This race that we're presently in, obviously, is of extreme importance to the number of people. So, for participation, I just don't know. I guess the other point I do want to add is that despite our feeling that people are closer to local government, we know that the vote that is highest consistently is the national vote. People vote for the president way up, 70%, 80%. And for city elections, for school elections, it's down to 20%, 25%, 30%. If we get up as high as, I think this primary, they figured 57% of the voters voted. That's extremely high for East Lansing, in this August primary. So all right, that's the side on voting. I guess my answer is there's no obvious relationship because other variables intervene. On administration, it's clear that most of the people would argue for larger size units in terms of, whatever your function is. You want to build highways for the area, how can you best administer it? They would say, well, if we have a larger unit, we can buy equipment, we can plan for the whole area, we can save you lots of money, whereas if you fritter your money away into 18 different little municipalities, each building their own highway.
Really, this gets back to the economic question. I was asking about the slippage in communications and so on. It seems to me that this, reading the newspaper, says this is a pretty prevalent phenomenon in Chicago, Detroit,
yeah,
cities like this.
Well, it's this notion you can't fight City Hall. Now, we do have one study of Detroit in administration. And again, it's the low-income people who are out no matter what the system is. I did a study in Grand Rapids, that's true, that relates to this. I found that in the suburbs, the people that gained most, whether you had a small unit or a large unit, the wealthy seemed to participate equally. In the central city, hardly a
smaller city. The middle class, roughly equally there. The pattern wasn't clear. The lower middle class did participate more in the smaller unit. And my guess is that these were people of agricultural backgrounds, township types, who somehow could feel freer access into a township unit than they could in Central City. As they got into a bigger unit, they just sort of got lost. Now, that might even disappear in the smaller unit as more suburbanites moved out. Now, the study of administration in Detroit indicated that, well, pretty much the same thing. It's a class phenomenon more than anything else, that they found the only thing that low-income people knew more about administration than upper-income was what? What do you think? The one thing they understood better than the upper-income people did.
Police.
Huh?
Police.
Well, maybe. They understood welfare. Well, they knew that, you know, hands down, they knew more about welfare. But anything else you asked them, they didn't know who was doing what and how it happened. I'm sorry, that's really about all I can say. There doesn't seem to be any clear. Mostly administrative types, though, not in terms of fighting, not in terms of participation, no, participation values, but in terms of economic values, would argue.
Let's push that a little further, though, Charlie.
Okay.
On the responsiveness of government to the preferences, not necessarily in terms of participation in elections, where it might not, participation may be a very poor sign of this, but where the individual feels that he can register his preferences by talking to the school board member or whatever it is.
You think it's better in a smaller unit? I suppose
I think so.
If you're in a majority, the smaller unit it is. If you're in the minority, it's not.
But the odds of being in a minority in a heterogeneous population is much higher than it is if you're in a more homogeneous. And these are related to size.
Yeah, but ask yourself, if you're a black in the big city, are you going to be better off in the big city or in the small town? Are you better off in Chicago or Mattoon, Illinois, if you're a black, say, particularly 10 years ago? Or if you're a sizable group of blacks? It's true, if you're in the majority in a small unit, if it's a middle-class suburb and you're in the middle class, yes, you have more access. Perhaps you even have more access if you're in the lower middle class, you're part of the unit. But if you're in the minority, I'm not sure you don't have more influence in the big city. I mean,
because of your capacity to organize, you mean?
Partly. I think it's professionalization.
Professionalization of the interest group?
The police in the larger cities are less likely to kick you in the teeth if you're a minority type. Now, that doesn't mean they're not going to do it there, too, but I just...
Look, it's partly just a pure matter of limited time of political bodies, organizations. In East Lansing, you can afford to spend time talking to the Bailey School mothers who want a lunch program.
Yeah.
In Detroit, you can't possibly do that because there would be 5,000 of them.
Yeah.
There's just no way.
Now, the real question then comes, could you decentralize Detroit? This is what the Ocean Hill Brownsville people are trying to say. Can't you decentralize within the bigger unit and really get more democracy in the end than having independent units?
Well, part of the question is how people participate, whether they try to participate as individuals or as very specific kinds of interest groups or as a larger group. And at least in Detroit, the blacks are a big enough group so they can make some kind of a splash.
Yeah.
I think part of the answer about whether you feel close to community or not depends not so much on actual participation but on feelings of potential of participation. People have been talking about the difference between what they call political efficacy or political effectiveness, feelings of political effectiveness, as opposed to feelings of personal efficacy. And it seems that for many people, it doesn't matter whether you have political power or not, but if you are if you feel personally effective, then you're satisfied and feel close to government. So, really what you're saying is that if you are middle class, then you feel close to government.
Well, see, I guess
that's not exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah, you're saying that.
No,
you know,
that's how it works out.
There are some aspects of that, but there are also fairly small minority groups who have somewhat different interests. If they can get a hearing, and it's often the case that the governing group isn't trying to do somebody in. There's no way for them to know that the trouble is down there because there's no way to get it up through the administration.
Well, this is one of the, but see, the what the real problem comes down to is decentralizing the large units. And you can become very romantic about this. I didn't go to a meeting yesterday, so I spent lunch listening to the fellow who went for our meeting to find out what the results were. We have, I hope I'm not revealing trade secrets here, we have 6,000 majors or students or however this thing is categorized who can vote, who may vote in an election in the College of Social Science. They held an election on something or the other, what the constituents they should be. How many people participated? I didn't guess, I way over-guessed it. I guessed 334. The actual number was 86, I don't know where. Now then you begin to ask yourself, well, somehow this isn't the way to decentralize within a unit, because clearly these students don't see any. How do you decentralize Michigan State University? We've tried the cluster college, which is terribly expensive, James Madison and so forth, Lyman Graves, Justin Morrill.
It's ungodly expensive.
All right. It's ungodly expensive. As long as Herb isn't here, I'll say that. We've tried the residence hall methods. When I went to school, I lived in what was called the zoo, the big dormitory, and they tried to break them off into halls. This was a method. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Some halls, we do get a group together that does form a baseball team that wins, and therefore they have some solidarity, and other halls have no relationship, I gather. The fraternities perform this function for some people, and the co-op houses, these other units.
I think we'll agree that there are various ways that you can... It isn't necessarily just the size.
Yeah, well, I'm convinced that the only way you really organize students in a university is by a professional core, that the veterinarians can organize, the journalists, I was in journalism school as an undergraduate, that was a unit we organized. The political scientists in a unit, are not a unit, in the college, the students of political science, I think you could organize a foreign service. In fact, we do have a club for those planning to go into the foreign service.
People have a real common interest.
But I guess I'd go back and really face this problem. It is a legitimate problem. How do you organize big units? The way it was phrased, there's a suggestion that you can break the large units down. You can go back to small colleges dotting the landscape of Michigan. I think that, again, is sort of romantic. This is silly. It just isn't going to happen. The real problem is how can you organize a Michigan State University with 42,000 students. Maybe 42,000 is too big, but what are the methods in which you can give people some relationship to something? Now, let me add quickly that many people don't care to have, they want to be lost in the crowd. They want to be in classes of 300. In fact, I myself as a student occasionally much prefer to be in a class of 300 than one with five where the guy had his eye on me every minute.
Let's go back a bit to this, to your notion of efficiency and economy. It seems to me what you're talking about there is minimum cost rather than efficiency. Given a particular set of services,
how can you
do it as a
May I just say this is the term that's used.
Yeah.
That's a standard